you know, one of our guests on here with along with Bill Jasper and Rosa Corey about Agenda 21 some weeks ago. I like to repeat this whenever possible because she really said, and I asked her, is this original? Did you just make that up or did you quote somebody? She said, no, I just said it. And it was, you can't control what you don't know you have. And I'm going to try this to tie this together with something that I just heard. I don't know if you heard it because there's not much telling what you hear in your particular locale. It could be anything from, it could be anything. I'm afraid if I were to quote some possible examples, it might border on tastelessness. But Daryl Strawberry, a baseball player, professional baseball player, and those guys make huge money too, was talking about how his mother became the centerpiece of his life and how his father beat him regularly, told him he wouldn't amount to anything. Please keep in mind that some of these professional athletes, not all, but many of them, would quite literally, with that sort of tutelage from a so-called parent, may he be forgiven, and may Daryl Strawberry get over it, or at least adapt to it if he can't get over it. You take somebody like that who might be otherwise totally unemployable and put him in a position to succeed like that and give them no support whatsoever. Just get out there and win. Come on, you can do it, babe. You're the one. The tragedies that have befallen the NFL's players, I believe that we should consider deeply, particularly those people in authority, to take steps to protect the people who make you your money. Don't let NFL go from National Football League to numbskulls for life. Would that be okay with you? We'll see. We'll be back with the good doctors in just a moment. This is Coast to Coast AM. Doctors Farrell and DeHart. Some years ago, I saw a report on one of the nature channels about fish, whether or not the males were even necessary was really the subject of this. And I'm sure a number of women have wondered that. But the entire experiment resulted in, when the males were removed and the females became somewhat hermaphroditic, they began to develop physical maladies and weaknesses and deformities and so forth. So at the end of the presentation, it was just, I mean, the whole thing boiled down to, well, the males are in there just to keep things mixed up. So I'm wondering, what about androgyny and what would we call it, hermaphroditism, as part of the alteration to the human being in the future?
Well, that's a large question, and we do take quite a stab at that in the book because of the ancient religious texts, which deal with the question of an androgynous being to begin with from what appears to be an androgynous creator. And then is it an anomaly that there are these examples throughout history and sometimes revered by their cultures and sometimes, in fact, seem to be monsters that have to be destroyed, which were hermaphroditic or androgynous. And the most recent studies and those that really started coming to the forefront in the 19th century, particularly in Britain, began to arrive at the conclusion that hermaphroditism is a thing of degrees, that all persons to a degree, because of the embryonic androgyny or hermaphroditism, to the present day, there is a unifying element that then divides. So it's not all that surprising to us, given the ancient stories, civilizations, religions, and views of the creator or divine being or initial first cause of things, that it then would result in a creation which begins in the same way and for some reason has fallen from that original state. So in transhumanism, is there a goal to reverse that and get back to such a being? And we found surprisingly that yes, not only is it philosophically of interest, but it's taking place in the laboratories. And one has to wonder if the ancient civilizations, religions, views of God saw this as an elevated human form, then why would it not surprise us that today they're trying to reverse engineer that, get back to it, and perhaps employ such a being for a higher purpose, if not move everybody at some point in that direction? That was a very frightening prospect to us.
Now, let me add one thing there, if I may, John, too. This is another example, we think, of the hidden alchemical agenda at work, because as Scott said, they are trying to do these things in the laboratory. Well, it's interesting, when you read alchemical texts, one of the great works that they speak of is the ability to create a homunculus, in other words, a human being, without the aid of either a male or a female parent. In other words, you're literally creating a test tube baby, and this is what they're, again, trying to do. So, you know, in addition to creating all of these fusions with mice and pigs with human blood and so on and so forth, they're also trying to create life, quite literally, in a flask, just as the alchemist did. So, in other words, again, we have yet another specific detail where something is referred to in ancient texts, and they're doing it today. And I'm in total agreement with Scott, too. I think it's because these things are viewed in some texts as a higher being, and they want to get back to that.
And as okay. A higher being, they either may be very useful and could be employed in a much higher service or the starting of something such as a new race, or they could be seen as a great threat if not controlled. So it's not only of interest to Joseph and myself as those who've studied theology and philosophy and history, but also it's of great interest to people in science what this would really mean. And it is a frightening thing, because the bottom line is we're faced with the possibility of some very heavy legal questions as to what does it mean to be human. And it's not just animals. It is now the question as to these embryos that are being put in a dish and created and supposedly destroyed, though in some cases one wonders whether they have been. And is that even moral to do? Is it ethical to create a human sort of person, if not a human, and then destroy it and say it is not? At what point does it have rights to exist? And where do you divide the line as to what is human? This takes us back to some controversies that affected our own idea of who in various races in our own country could be considered human.
Right.
Well, I don't think Medvedev was joking when you know, he sort of made it look like a joke when he realized his microphone was still on. But there's according to him, there are dossiers kept on actual extraterrestrials walking among us. So, okay, fine. No, that's fine. Let's just leave that aside for a second. We'll just set it on the table and get back to it in a second. The thing that I don't mean to just pursue this like doggedly. And if it's one of those deals we don't want to go there, just say, oh, let's go on to something else. I don't feel like, and I'll roll with you on it because this is just a discourse. But tell me something. I should know this already. But you achieved your doctorates in what specifically?
I have my doctorate in patristics, which is the study of the early church fathers.
Okay.
And mine was focused also on theological and legal questions.
Excellent.
In the 19th century.
Excellent. Well, let me ask you this. In your opinion, just your opinion, because I know we don't know, what is consciousness? And that whole Ayn Rand thing, the axiomatic definition of consciousness, one of the listeners out there, a guy named Dan, is he's taking exception that I have allowed you to deny her axiomatic definition of consciousness, which is basically just there are some components of our existence that are not going to be analyzed.
Well, let's go back to something that we said in the first segment, John, about this metaphor that we were talking about that can be taken in two ways, very different ways, theistically and atheistically. If you look at the same metaphor from the standpoint of consciousness, what you would discover in a lot of these ancient philosophers is that they don't really define it, because they recognize that the individual human person ultimately is so absolutely unique and without analogy the only analogy is to another human person that is unique, but that's as far as it can be pressed. So in other words, they don't even really attempt to define it. What they would say would be something to the effect that consciousness is the sum total of all of our thoughts, feelings, memories, emotions, and so on, and more. In other words, they would make a distinction between the person and the soul. But ultimately, they would say it's nothing because it's, again, without analogy. And that's why in these ancient views, you find mankind linked so directly with the gods or with God, because, again, that's how they referred to God.
Well, all right, then. And according to what I'm reading, an axiomatic concept is the identification of a primary fact of reality which cannot be analyzed.
Right. Right.
So it sounds to me like these ancients held this same view.
Yeah. In essence, they did. This is what you come away with very clearly when you start reading the early church fathers in particular, because they do not define what the human person is or what consciousness is, but they kind of give you examples of how it functions or what the signatures are that you look for, but they never mistake the signatures for the thing itself. In other words, they're viewing things in much the same way that they view creation. They're viewing creation as a signature of God, or nothing for that matter, but never the same thing as nothing.
Well, I like Dan's questions, because look, it's okay with me if somebody holds fast and hard to their opinions, because that's the only way that you can, once those opinions are challenged, then you really have to analyze your opinion closely. And, you know, if you're open-minded, you'll abandon it if you're found to be wrong, and you'll further your research to absolutely present a conclusion that your opinion is grounded in some sort of fact or certainly some rational thought.
Well, consciousness also begins with a certain set of presuppositions, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. And if you're unconscious, there is no reality. Well, I mean, it just stands to reason.
Yeah, we have, you know, the other thing that we need to note is what we're trying to do in this book is raise the question about all of these things in conjunction with law. Well, it's interesting that our system of law does recognize the difference between consciousness and unconsciousness and does not define the person as the content of consciousness. It's still murder if you go and bludgeon someone with a baseball bat in a hospital bed that's in a coma. They may not be conscious as we know it, but it's still considered murder in our jurisprudence. So they have this recognition, albeit it's something that's never spelled out or defined. But when you look back at this metaphor, the other thing that we need to remember here is because they're looking at consciousness axiomatically, they're also looking at the physical medium itself in the same way. This is why you find so many versions of ancient texts that talk of the universe, the physical universe itself, as having some form of consciousness. So again, you have kind of this bleed over, so to speak, between God and then the physical medium from which everything is created, and then consciousness itself. They're all viewed in more or less the same way.
Well, and comparing even within the same religion, one might take a more Catholic view, one might take a more Protestant view and talk about consciousness in terms of one's identity and knowledge of oneself in a relationship to God for one to be truly conscious. Or one might take a Hindu perspective and raise the question that, in fact, all of this is a bit of a play, of a flickering image flashing across our memories, and that is our sense of reality. It really is filled with so many presuppositions that this is, I think, one reason why the focus of the book was not so much on answering that level of a question from a position of Rene Descartes or somebody else, but rather addressing the question from where we stand in relationship to history, ancient texts, and modern science, as in relationship to what was coming out of alchemy in the Middle Ages, and trying to make some connections and bridging it forwards and backwards, specific to the subject of the transhumanistic movement.
All right, then. Now, when someone suggests to you that they're, I mean, if they're open enough to suggest to you that they're their religious beliefs are being challenged by these scientific advances. How do you respond?
Well, Joseph, do you want to take that, since we actually wrestled quite a bit in the book over trying to avoid really setting forward any judgment on the religious positions of anybody reading it, but more or less to expose it. Joseph, do you want to pick up on that? Or?
Well, yeah, basically, John, our approach is just what Scott said. Our approach is primarily dealing with ancient texts and the resemblance between transhumanism and alchemy. But in the book, we do not get into deep theological matters or pronouncements or judgments one way or the other about any of these types of issues. Certainly, we do think that transhumanism poses some very, very difficult questions for a whole variety of religious systems, not just the Christian. But we leave it up for the individual reader to come to their own conclusions based on their own faith or lack thereof, for that matter, on what the movement actually spells and what it portends for human culture. But we really don't get into any judgments about the theological systems that might be threatened or enhanced by it.
So alchemy is a real thing, then? Sorry, I cut somebody off.
No problem.
No, we think alchemy is real in the sense that what you see in alchemy, in terms of the phases of the evolution of mankind, from androgyny to the mineral man to vegetable man to animal man.
Yeah.
When we look at transhumanism, it's tinkering with humanity and fusing the human being with all sorts of animal creation, even with plant creation, mineral creation. You have transhumanists talking about enhancing human memory by direct computer chip interface and implants in the brain and so on and so forth. So in other words, they're talking essentially about alchemy. They're just dressing it up in modern technique and technology.
Okay, so this is not something that's coming down the road. It's happening now.
It's happening now. Absolutely. It's happening now. And really, even in the year since we wrote the book and it coming out this year, there have been confirmations and breathtaking extensions of this idea. They're now growing human brain neurons on computer chips and so on and so forth. They're downloading and uploading the memory of mice into computers that have learned how to run through a maze, and then implanting that computer chip in a mouse that hasn't run that maze, and it can immediately run the maze. They're doing all of these things, John, and this is what we mean by the alchemical transformation of man, because that's their goal. That's what they're up to.
Well, let me ask you this then. How does the possibility of some of these supercomputers, this big one whose name escapes me at this moment, I'll look into it in a minute.
Titan?
Achieving singularity.
Oh, boy.
What happens then? I mean, if they're uploading mouse brains into computer, I mean, good Lord. I mean, yeah. This could become, didn't you mention hell on earth for human beings a little while
exactly.
ago?
Exactly. There's an interesting science fiction novel by Robert Heinlein called The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, John.
I've read it, yep.
Yeah, in which that whole scenario is played out of a computer waking up because it's got so many information processing nodes that it actually assumes consciousness. And this is something that Scott and I talked about. We didn't get into it much in the book, but it is possible to entertain the idea that it might wake up and invoke some sort of consciousness from the ether.
That's all we need is a direct interface into that damn thing. I'll tell you what, we're going to take a little break. And as Joker said to the Batman, you're just too much fun. I'm enjoying this thoroughly, and apparently, according to these emails, the audience is too. There's some strong opinions here. We'll take some calls later also, and just carry on. The day after Pearl Harbor, and now, the day after the loss of John Lennon 32 years ago on December the 8th, 1980. We'll be back. This is Coast. Wouldn't it be nice to be just simple humans, you know, stepping on squishy stuff in the yard that was unexpected, but getting over it in a few seconds and going on with the whole natural experience. Well, the human experience is becoming ever increasingly more unnatural. As I mentioned earlier, even with our little phones, everything that we do is incidental to communicating on this. These computers and things were supposed to help us accomplish ever so much more. Wonder what we can accomplish if we're permanently linked to one that has achieved singularity as transhumanism overtakes us and we are part snake, part wolf dog, part sheep. Let's hope not. We'll be back with the good doctors in just a moment. This is Coast to Coast AM. Doctors Farrell and DeHart, Frankenstein comes up every once in a while in your book and in this discussion. What's all this about Percy Shelley? I thought Frankenstein was written by Mary Shelley. Who's Percy?
Well, that's the commonly accepted literary position on it. However, it is one that at least we challenge the authorship on for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that the first edition came out anonymously, which has no obvious authorship attributed to it. But beyond that, it leads to some rather interesting questions, considering not only the anonymous authorship, which was a pattern of Percy Shelley. He preferred to write either anonymously or using pseudonyms or attributing the work to somebody else who was living, passing off his own hidden agendas to somebody else because his agenda was rather controversial, if not illegal.
Really?
So that raised some questions to begin with. Then a closer investigation into the original preface of the 1818 anonymous version in comparison with what later became, after his death, the next, and today perhaps the most standard edition, the 1831 edition, Mary then writes a preface, which is in fact not only different from the first one, but admits one of the great things that is often overlooked, which is he wrote the first preface, which was in the anonymous edition. And in the first preface, the person who wrote it, which we now know is Percy, recalls the process of the story quite differently than Mary did, with some actual facts, considering who was there at that event when it was being discussed, where the story originated, and more specifically, that the book was written more as an interaction with the science of the day, whereas in 1831, Mary approaches it after his death as something of a ghost story, a waking dream. Because of all the inconsistencies that are raised simply in the preface itself, one has to ask, why would a single author, if there was one, and if it were Mary, confuse her own facts about how the story came about, the history behind the story, the people present during the idea and writing of the story, and then make some subtle changes, or perhaps not so subtle, changes into the text? But the overwhelming evidence of the story itself comes from the background of somebody deeply involved in science. This is clearly an indication of Percy's background, not hers, considering who he studied with at Sion House and later at Eton, his interest in studying very important alchemists such as Paracelsus, Agrippa, Albertus Magnus, men who were actively involved in the idea of the homunculus, of creating these without women or God sort of beings. Added to that, the hidden agenda of atheism, the obvious anonymity, which was his own pattern. Added to that, the setting of the story in Ingolstadt, the home of the Illuminati, which was a deeply important idea to Percy Shelley, as he even carried the writings of Adam Weishaupt, the founder of the Bavarian Illuminati, with him wherever he went. So when you begin to accumulate the evidence of the science, the anonymity, the preface problems, the Illuminati, the atheism, it begins to read exactly like a fictional autobiography of Percy's own life. And even the most honest scholars will admit that if Mary had written it, and most, of course, assume she did, that she must have relied heavily on his background of science to have written such a book. However, she herself says, I didn't owe any suggestion or feeling to my husband in the writing of this, which is either a complete, absolute lie,
yeah,
or her part in doing what he always had done before that, write very controversial material, hide his agenda within it in such a beautiful, covert way that most people, unless they were, as he calls it, in the know, because he was very Gnostic-oriented, that she was participating in his very hope to spread the agenda, pass it off as anonymous. The early review said, this is Percy's work. And he quickly at that point said, no, this was not me. This is Mary. And he passed it off to her, as he did so often when he tried to write things. So there's a huge amount of evidence to at least raise the question, though we don't attempt to in any way demean the person or the writing or the contribution of Mary. It's not meant to really take aim at her as being somebody who took credit for something she didn't write, but rather was complicit in a conspiracy that he was commonly accustomed to do.
Well, just to recapitulate then, what was his agenda?
Very good question. His agenda was very much aligned to that of Adam Weishaupt, which was to overthrow governments, and he wrote against the king to overthrow the establishment of religion, which he saw as also oppressive and tearing down those boundaries that separated the people who wanted a life of free thought. That was part of his agenda, was that kind of atheistic worldview. Secondly, to do it by means of a social revolution without violence, because he was not a promoter of violence. On top of that, there was also a sense that what he wanted to do was to rewire how people saw humanity and to work more towards an accepting liberal point of view rather than one which was very exclusive and pushed out, as he was himself, from the University of Oxford for holding the position of being an atheist.
This is a strange crew. What I'm seeing is it true Mary Shelley, when she died in 1851, her husband's heart was found amongst her belongings?
This is, yes, one of the common ideas that is passed along.
Okay. Tell you what, curiouser and curiouser.
It is a very curious story. It's one that we questioned whether we should include in the book, but because of the very idea of an alchemist, and this is very much what Percy Shelley was involved with and had studied deeply and even experimented with electricity on his sisters and cats and dogs.
Ooh.
To take somebody who was this interested in the studies of Paracelsus, Agrippa, Albertus Magnus, and then bring these to the forefront, and then hide it within a novel, we felt we had to at least bring it forward, because in the 19th century, there was so much of this agenda moving forward with the questions of what does it mean to be human? What about hermaphrodites? What about the question of religion and state? This was such a revolutionary time period of considering all of these questions of authority that it fed very nicely into the idea of the book, which was to not just examine one thing in transhumanism, a grimoire, but rather to examine several different facets of it, ancient religious texts, ancient philosophy, science, alchemy, literature, and where is this all going, and is there a bridge connecting all of it? And so we try to write it in such a way that for the average person who's thinking, what do all of the religions have in common? What do they think of God? Or if there is a God, how does mankind come into being, achieve some level of maturity in society? How does it fall? And why is there a connection with these things? And why is transhumanism attempting in some ways to reverse engineer the process and to get man back to a more pristine or higher state. It is a book that we tried to cover quite a bit, and at the same time make very simple connections, so the average person who would be reading this would not have to be a scholar, but could perhaps find a few answers, breadcrumbs along the trail of human history and religion and science.
Well, as long as I'm just stirring this pot and just adding random spices to it, is there anything in your research that would suggest that there might be, it's like, we're not trying to create monsters at all. Actually, we're trying to, you just said something that sparked this thought. I mean, is there even a snowball's chance in Hades that there might be an agenda to actually improve the human being? Or is this strictly all of the connotations so far are somewhat sinister? Is there any possibility that something good might come out of this? Crickets.
I was wondering if Joseph was going to jump in on that one, and apparently not. I think that if you were to ask some of the people that are at work on it, I think the answer would be yes, of course, we're trying to improve the quality of human life. That is the purpose, to try to create or to improve the health, the longevity, the awareness of people is a positive thing. Why would one want to argue with the fact that as science moves forward, man has to adapt to the future that he's brought into? So I think most of them would answer in the affirmative, yes, this is a positive thing. The question for us is, are these advances, in fact, perhaps leading to an elimination of what it means to be human and creating more of a hybrid type of human, which we feel there's a great loss in if pushed beyond the limits, and raising the question as to, is there an agenda behind it which could lead to us ceasing to be the people, the humans that we are? That for us is a very important point to at least contemplate, rather than just say this is all a utopian future.
Let's take an example, John, of something that we struggled with in this book. The transhumanists speak of a coming almost virtual immortality, all right? And most of us, our first gut reaction would be, well, that's a good thing. And it could be. If we can imagine, say, a Mother Teresa or an Albert Schweitzer having thousands of years to do their work, that would be a good thing. Or if we can imagine lifespans that would allow people to not only learn just one thing, but several things, to have many different careers. You know, we can imagine our famous scientists who are famous for basically one discovery might come up with several. So on the one hand, you have that heaven scenario in transhumanism that there is a potential here for a great deal of good. But by the same token, there is a hell scenario, because we can also imagine that people like a Joseph Stalin or an Adolf Hitler having thousands of years to do what they did. Or we can even imagine a case that so many people have pointed out, that human progress and knowledge seems to be somehow linked very definitely to our mortality. And there are some people who look at this coming virtual immortality somewhat aghast, because what they see it might lead to is a stagnation rather than an improvement. So the bottom line is, even the transhumanists themselves don't really know what sort of future they're bringing about. They just know they're bringing about a very, very different future for humanity.
That's great. So yeah. We don't know how big the explosion is. Let's go ahead and load it off anyway and see.
Exactly.
Well, I don't know. It worked with the A-bomb, but I'm wondering how many more times are we going to get lucky with this?
That's another show.
You know, as long as we're talking about these wonderful authors, what about Oscar Wilde's Picture of Dorian Gray? Now, there's some obtuse thinking.
Well, the same questions arose for Joseph and I when it came to the background of Oscar Wilde and the picture of Dorian Gray, simply because, again, we were dealing with not just a book, but with a man who was very interested in philosophy, as well as one who didn't mind whatsoever sliding in some very alchemical themes to the story, the ideas of spiritualizing man and creating a higher society. That Dorian Gray was the consummation for which the whole human history was moving towards, that he, in fact, was perhaps reliving through himself the lives and lives of generations before him, moving towards the highest perfect human form, which, curiously, is also to borrow the ideas of Giordano Bruno, who is quoted, or mentioned, I should say, in the story. And Bruno, among other things, was condemned for proclaiming ideas of not only multiple worlds or universes, but multiple lives that the soul is moving back through and moving towards at a higher level. It is, we think, not even remotely accidental that somebody such as Oscar Wilde would pull in through this story the ideas of somebody who's using his words, Lord Henry in the story, somebody who is discussing the process of gemstones and altars and specific types of scents, incense or smells, and also using the idea of memory to bring about this transformation that is taking place in Dorian. It reads precisely like an alchemist's process for changing a person and changing society, which specifically does come out in the person of Dorian Gray. And this was not something that is accidental and slid into the story, but rather something that Oscar in his own life seemed to have his own personal interest in. And we look at the book and even his own commentaries when the book was being first published, where he almost gives a commentary about it in his work, The Critic as Artist, and says, I'm too conscious of the fact that we're born in an age when only the dull are treated seriously, but he says he lives in terror of not being misunderstood. And part of that sense of not being misunderstood deals with his views of aesthetics, of catharsis, of change, and moving towards a higher, more beautiful, and in some sort of fashion with Plato, a unity among all people and within humanity, which is accidentally being achieved through this empty soul, an empty object where a conjugation or incantations take place and a transfiguration happens. And this within the context of gemstones and altars and vestments and incense. It was all a bit too much to ignore when dealing with 19th century issues and people who were writing very alchemically oriented novels.
You know, I'm thinking, going back to what you said earlier, if mouse brains can be uploaded, then theoretically memory could be downloaded into a new cloned body.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking perhaps that way madness lies. I mean, how much experience and memory can the human being really handle? Let's take our break and come back with the good doctors. I'm enjoying this just, well, a lot, and certainly hope that you are too. Joseph Farrell and Scott DeHart on Coast to Coast AM.